This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
I admitted something last week, really, and although I made mention of it this morning, it's a pleasure for me to say it again this evening, is to welcome into our midst Rabbi Tesler, who was present at the shul last week and again this week. I won't say over the words of very inadequate praise that I gave him this morning, because that embarrassed him enough. Merely to say that I feel very honored that he takes the time to be at the base of Medrash and to sit in the shir on Matzah Shabbos. He's busy, he's here for a short period of time. He comes from Eretz Yisrael, where there's no shortage of Torah. He himself is a great Talmud Chochem in his own right, and I know that he comes only to show Derech Eretz, and not because there's anything that he can learn, and I value it very deeply. You've heard of this transactional analysis, I'm okay, you're okay thing that goes around. What we're going to talk about tonight is I'm okay, you're not okay. And that's the correct way to perceive the world. We're told that the inadequate way, the people who really have problems see it as I'm not okay, you're okay. That's the person who always sees himself as the Nebuch. And I'm okay, you're not okay. He's arrogant and he's aggressive and he thinks he owns the place. And the right way is, I'm okay, you're okay. We're going to see this evening that that's not so at all. That the correct way to perceive the world is, I'm okay, you're not okay. And we'll see why. A long time ago, our forefather, Avraham Avinu, was sitting outside his tent, feeling very uncomfortable, in a great deal of pain, and very ill. On the hottest day in human history. And three guests walk along whom he thinks are Arabs. They're certainly not Jews. And they're traveling, they walk by, and he invites them in. How does he invite them in? He invites them to have something to eat. Vayemaher Avrohom ha'oihelo, and Avrohom rushes off to the tent, El Soro, to his wife Soro. Vayemir, and he says, Mahari, hurry up, shalosh seim kemach soiles. Three saw of soiles lushi needed vasi ugois and bake challahs. Ve'el habakorot Avrohom, they didn't have any refrigeration, so if he was going to throw a banquet at short notice, what did he have to do? He couldn't phone up the butcher and order meat, and he couldn't go to the freezer and take it out to the deep freeze. There was only one thing to do, that was going to go out to the pen and to shecht an animal. So he had to shecht an animal, and he had to take the animal rach vatoi vayiten el anar vayemahil soi. He had a shecht, he had a cut up, treber, salt and soak, cook, prepare. That took several hours. While they were preparing the main meal, he took chemo, the cholov, butter and milk, and he gave them a milchiki meal while they were waiting for the main meal to come. And he served them under the tree, and they ate. So there we can picture this man, an old man, suffering enormous pain, and feeling ill on the hottest day of the year, hottest day of human history, anywhere in the world, with no air conditioning, no refrigeration, and all of a sudden he's got to throw a banquet for three guests, and a banquet he provides for them. And what's the result of that little action? The result is that because of that we got the mon in the desert. The whole of the Jewish people were sustained for 40 years in the desert with mon, as a result of that one action of Avraham Avinu. V'haba'ir oil Elohim, v'aslav motzu Elohim, v'ananei kovid makifin oisom. It was because of that action that there was the well of Miriam. It was because of that action that there was the slav, the quail came. And it was because of that action that there was the ananei kovid, the clouds of glory that surrounded the people. All the most wonderful things that protected our entire nation through their journey in the desert over a period of 40 years can all be attributed to that one action of our forefather Avraham, an act of chesed. But the Medrash says a strange thing, which of course is striking as soon as we think about it. The Medrash on today's Seder in Parsha Lamed Daled says There are different types of Baalei Chesed. And the one is, Mishu she'oso chesed im mishu loy hayu tzrichim. Where is an example in the Torah of somebody doing chesed to a person who didn't need it? Avraham im malachi ha'shoris. Avraham who did chesed to these angels. They weren't Arabs, they were angels, and as such they didn't need nourishment. They didn't need the milchik meal before, and they didn't need the fleshik meal afterwards. It was all for nothing. There was no reason. They weren't hungry. It didn't do anything for them. It didn't help them. It didn't sustain them. They got no pleasure out of it. Absolutely nothing. It was an act that had no meaning in a real sense. No practical meaning whatever. It's true there was a great deal of Mesiras Nefesh. It's true that Avraham went to enormous effort and put in great energy in order to provide that meal. But to whom? To beings that were fictitious beings. They weren't real human beings. They were angels. He served them under the tree and they ate. Did they really eat? No, it looked as if they were eating. It was Hollywood special effects, that's all. They weren't really eating and drinking, they were angels. And how did Hashem repay his children for this act of chesed, which was no chesed at all? Aman yored lohem, va'be'eru ile lohem, va'aslov motzui lohem, va'anane kovid mekifin loison, va'omud ha'ono noisei alifnehem. That was the repayment for that act of kindness to a being who didn't need the kindness in the first place. Va'harei devorim kal v'chomer. And from this we can draw a kal v'chomer, says the Chazal. U'ma im misho oso chesed im misho ino tzorich lechesed. If one who did chesed, who did kindness to a being who didn't need that kindness, Torah HaKadosh Baruch Hu Levonov, the Ribbono Shel Olam, repays his children with such enormous repayment. Misha is a chesed in Misha Tzorich Alach As Kama Vekama. Can you imagine what repayment there is for one who does chesed to a being who really needs it? If that's how a man is repaid for doing a chesed that wasn't needed and that achieved no purpose, a meaningless act of chesed in the human sense. And yet he was repaid with such enormous wealth for his children. And the whole nation is saved and sustained for 40 years in the desert in the most miraculous way. With a mon, and we're told, Lo'inisna Torah lo'ichle hamon. The Torah could only be given to a generation who ate the mon. That means if it weren't for the mon, we wouldn't have been fitting for the receipt of the Torah. So the giving of the Torah was a result of that. That entire Bamidbar experience, that whole 40 years in the desert, was all based on one act of chesed of one man many years before. And an act of chesed that was of no purpose, that was no consequence, because the recipients of the chesed didn't even need that chesed. Can you imagine what repayment there is, says the Medrash, when we do an act of chesed for somebody who needs the chesed? That's the value of chesed. And we need to understand this a little bit. What is chesed then? That means that Hashem values chesed irrespective of the extent to which it is useful. That the utilitarian aspect of chesed is irrelevant. The extent to which it actually serves a purpose is not part of the measuring process of the value of the chesed. It doesn't matter whether it's needed or it's not needed. On the contrary, even if there's no need at all, there's enormous repayment. Yes, if it's needed, even more so, but it means that chesed can be valued to the extreme. Even in a situation where it's fulfilling no real purpose whatever. What does it all mean? It requires us to redefine our understanding of chesed. Because until now we've understood chesed as taking care of people's needs. Somebody needs something, to be sensitive to it, to notice it, and to take care of their needs. Whether it's an emotional need, or it's a physical need, or a material need, or a spiritual need, but whatever it is, somebody needs some Gemara to be explained to him, and you explain him some Gemara, that's a chesed. Somebody needs some hospitality, you provide the hospitality, that's a chesed. Somebody needs to borrow money, and you lend him money, that's a chesed. But in our superficial understanding of chesed, there is no act of chesed in helping somebody to understand a piece of Gemara that he knows very well already, and that you're giving him nothing new. There's no chesed in that. There's no chesed in lending a multimillionaire money who's busy, who doesn't need the money. Go to Harry Oppenheim and say, look, chesed and all that, you're a fellow Jew after all. You know that I feel I've got this little gemach that I run, and I provide interest free loans to Jews. I would like you to take, I can only manage 100 rand, but I would like to lend you 100 rand. That's a big deal. Chesed, is that an act of chesed? He doesn't need it. What is chesed then? We see right away in learning this medrash, the first thing we see is that we don't know what chesed is, we don't know what chesed means. That's one of the exciting things about learning Torah generally, and one of the disturbing things about learning Torah is each time when you look at a chazal in any area in Torah, the first thing that strikes you when you ask a few pertinent questions is you realize that you don't know what you're talking about. You realize that you don't understand anything. What is chesed? Think of all the poor people who aren't at the shir tonight. They didn't know what chesed is, just as we didn't know what chesed is, except by the end of the shir in Yirtzeh Hashem, we'll have a better understanding of what chesed is. And all the people who went at the shir still don't know what chesed is. Never. And they can go through their whole lives like that. Whole lives. If one isn't exposed to this chazal, one doesn't analyze it, you can go through your whole life without knowing what chesed is. Let me give you an example, and perhaps we'll be able to get a clearer perception of it in that sense. Imagine if you go and you're watching a play or a film, and it's one of these tearjerkers, really sad film, terribly tragic, terribly sad. From the beginning to the end, it's just, and it's well done, and it's powerful, and it gets you totally involved. And you look in front of you, and there are two people sitting in front of you, and the one person's tissue box is just about empty. He or she is busy wiping their eyes and sobbing their little hearts out. And the person next to him or her is sitting with an impassive face, looking totally unmoved. What do you think? How does it affect you? So rationally you should say, let's assume just for argument's sake that the one who was crying was a lady and the other one was a man. It doesn't have to be that way. But rationally you should say the lady's foolish. It's fiction, it's nonsense, never happened. It's just Hollywood manipulating our emotions, and she's crying, this silly girl. And he is fine, he's sitting detached, he's looking at it as an artistic, analyzing it artistically, and it doesn't move him at all. But we don't come out with that feeling. We say, what kind of a hard person is this that can sit and sit through a film like this, or sit through a play like this, and not be moved to tears? So which is correct, the way we view it rationally? The rational response is not to cry. The emotional response is to cry. It's interesting though that you can find people who will cry in the movie, and when they walk out and there's some beggars sitting outside, they'll walk right past them. That relates back to last week's Motzei Shabbos shiur. Much easier to believe in fiction than to believe in the truth. Much easier to cry when you've got some millionaire stars acting poverty on the screen than to cry when there's somebody really sitting outside who's got nothing to eat. Much easier to cry for the Hollywood millionaires than to cry for the beggar, because the Ribono Shel is built into the Bria, as we learned last week, an inability to cope with the truth, that we can't cope with the truth and we don't want to cope with the truth. We'll believe anything but the truth. What we're saying, it appears, is that chesed is the way we respond to human situations, not necessarily to specific human beings. That there's such a thing as describing, as defining a situation which arouses in us a sense of chesed, a sense of wanting to do something about it, a feeling, an identity. One can think of many such examples. I remember in yeshiva once a chaver of mine, a friend of mine, getting very frustrated and aggravated with me. We were sitting or walking, I don't remember, in Yerushalayim, and he stopped and he was watching a lady at a shop counter. We might have been in the shop, I actually don't remember where we were, and she was buying something, and she had finished the transaction, and she was scratching around in her purse to find her money. And he stopped and he looked and he said, isn't that tragic, isn't that so pathetic, just look at that, a lady scratching in her purse to find money. And I said, what's so pathetic about that? He said, don't you see, doesn't it strike you, doesn't it want to make you cry? I said, no, what's it do? And if it was a man scratching in his purse for the money, would it want to make you cry? He said, no. I said, why? That was the end of the conversation. He felt that he couldn't waste any more time on me. There wasn't, if I couldn't understand that. And it was only years later. There is such a thing as looking at a situation so rationally that nothing about it is pathetic. And there is such a thing as looking at a situation so emotionally that everything about it is pathetic. One can actually seek the pathos in human situations. And what he was saying was, really, that lady ought to have a husband standing next to her that would pay for her. Now, why ought to? No, you can't explain it rationally, and that's how it's supposed to be, and that's how it's not a legal thing that it's supposed to be that way, that's not a social thing that it's supposed to be that way. But that she has to pay for her own thing, and she was scratching around in her purse for the. It just made him feel sore. He perceived pathos in that situation. Most people don't perceive pathos in that situation. I didn't perceive pathos in that situation. But as one grows and develops and moves through life, one begins to find more and more pathos in situations which don't necessarily look pathetic on the surface. People react differently to different scenes. I remember sitting in an aeroplane as we were taking off over a city, an enormous city, you saw in the evening, it was very beautiful, a very clear night, and you could see all the little lights. It looked extremely beautiful. And I was sitting at the window and totally absorbed in looking out at these little lights, and the person sitting on my right could also see through the window, and he too was totally tantalized by these lights, and we were both looking and looking, and we were oblivious of each other. And then he broke the silence first, and he said, "Isn't it beautiful?" And that contrasted so much with what was going through my thoughts. I was looking down at these hundreds of thousands of little lights, and I thought to myself, each of those little lights is a home. And what's going on inside the home? Their little children struggling with their new teeth. Their little children struggling with their homework. Their little children crying over a broken friendship or a breaking down in a love relationship. There's a husband and wife who maybe aren't getting on that well. There's a sick child. There's a sick parent. There's a dying grandparent. There's somebody struggling to make a living. Each little house has its little tzoros. Every one of them, all of them, these little houses. And his comment was, "How beautiful." And as I looked out, there were virtually tears running down my eyes as I was looking at this beauty. For in every situation of beauty, there is also a situation of pathos. And it depends how you look at it. There isn't a human situation that doesn't involve some identification with pathos, if we want to see it. And that's a way of understanding a slightly different dimension to what the Maseilas Yesharim says right in the beginning, when he says this world is not a place for pleasure. It doesn't work that way. Because on one level, he says, you find, "Ki mi ein chaye ha'odom ba'ilom hazeh, oy mi hu shesomeach b'sholev mamesh ba'ilom hazeh." What is life in this world? Who's really happy if you look at it in a material sense? A person lives for 70 years, 80 years, during which time there's suffering, there's pain, there's illness, there's worry, there's concern, and at the end of it all, what? After all the problems. And if you go and you visit any psychologist, you see the problems. If you visit any rabbi, you see the problems. If you go and look on the bookshelves of any bookstore, you see by the kind of books which are written, everybody's trying to solve problems all the time. And at the end of it, what? At the end of it, v'achar kol zeh, after it all, hamoves, death. Echod bin elef lo yimso shiyah beholim lo hanoves v'shavoim. He says, one in a thousand you'll find are really happy in the world. That's not what it's for. That can't be what the world is designed for, to make a person happy. And then he says earlier on, a person finds himself in this world at all times in conflict. Because everything in the world, whether good or bad, it all puts a person under pressure. If a person is poor, that's a pressure. If a person is wealthy, that's another pressure. Says, if a person has it too easy, that's a pressure. If he suffers, that's another pressure. So you look forward, backwards, wherever you look, you're facing a struggle, you're facing a battle. That's the world. So there's nobody to look at with a sense of, aren't they lucky? There's really no such thing. I'll never forget when I just got married and I took Serena down to Stellenbosch, where I was the rabbi at the time. And she got to know the families then, she got to know the community after a few weeks, and she said, "We're wasting our time here. Everybody's so well adjusted, everybody's so happy, everybody's doing just fine. What contribution can we make here?" By the end of the year that we'd spent together there after that, I said to her, "Is there one family here that's happy, that's well adjusted, that's well settled?" And we thought and we went through them all, and there wasn't one. Everyone had its difficulties, everyone had its problems, everyone had the things that it had to deal with at different times during that year. And I said to her then, that's one of the things we'd have to remember wherever we go, anywhere in the world, that there is no such thing as an individual or a family who's well adjusted and doesn't have problems. No such thing. It can be temporarily so, but generally the whole world, that's what the Mesillas Yeshurim means. All of life for every human being is a process of coming to grips with struggles and battles. We have our difficulties, we have our problems, we have our pain. Sure, we have our pleasures and our simchas and our joys as well. Doesn't mean it's all negative and heavy and horrible. Chas v'sholom. But don't let look and think that other people, that anybody, has it easy. There is nobody who has it easy. It doesn't matter what wealth they might have, or what health they might have, or whatever they might have. We need to accept that as a klal, we need to accept that as a principle. There is nobody in this entire world who has it easy. Nobody at all. Everybody has their difficulties, everybody has their problems, everybody has their challenges. And what we need to relate to is, we need to, this Medrash seems to be saying to us, is we need to find the pathos and relate to it. And I would say on the basis of this Medrash that the lady who's crying her heart out at that play or at that film is the one who's the more sensitive one. It doesn't matter that it's not real. A picture is being painted, a picture is being portrayed, a human situation is being portrayed. She's not crying for the actors, she knows they're actors. She knows when they finish their actors, they go to their mansions in Hollywood. She's not crying for them. She's crying for the human situation which they're portraying, which is real. And she knows it's real. And that's why she's crying. She sees that. These three angels come in. It's true Avraham Avinu didn't know that they were angels. It's true that at that point he thought they were ordinary human beings. And he provides a banquet for them. Because he projects and he feels and he says these are people who've just been walking. He doesn't inquire whether they're hungry. He doesn't analyze them. He doesn't put them under some kind of medical test to see whether they're human beings or angels, to come to some kind of rational decision as to what their needs are. When a person starts weighing up what the other person's needs are, that's ois chesed, that's not chesed, that might be tzedakah. If a person comes to me for charity, I'm entitled to analyze together with him what are your needs. But when it comes to chesed, I'm not entitled to analyze what are your needs. When I start using my mind to analyze, I've already missed the opportunity for chesed. Chesed is an impulse. Chesed is a natural response to a tragic human situation. And even an angel can create the image of a tragic human situation. Of people who've been traveling on such a terribly hot day, whether they need the meal or not, they're painting a picture of terrible need, of great suffering, of enormous hunger and thirst. And Avraham responds immediately. He can't sit still, despite his own illness, despite his own pain and suffering. He can't sit still. He needs to respond to that. That's chesed. Chesed is not measured in terms of what the other person needs. Chesed is the ability of the subject to perceive pathos in the object and to respond to that perception of pathos. What happens if we don't? If we don't respond to somebody who needs something, that's very serious. Somebody needs, somebody's dying of hunger and I don't respond to his need and he dies, that death is on my hands. But if he's not dying of hunger, the case of the angel, what would have happened had Avraham not given them anything to eat? They wouldn't have been any more hungry. There would have been no difference whatever to their situation. So it's true, maybe we would not have been rewarded in that way. The Jewish people would not have had Mon and Slav and the Be'er and the Anone Kovid and the Midbar. Who knows what would have happened? That would have been bad enough. But would there have been any kind of punishment over and above that? We would assume not. But the Medrash continues. Let us seek an example of somebody who didn't do chesed to an object, to somebody else, who didn't need chesed. Is there such a case of where there wasn't a need and the need wasn't, and that need that wasn't fulfilled? Seems an absurd case to seek, but there is such a case. Ammoni u'Moavi in Yisrael. The Ammoni and the Moavi, when Yisrael were going through their land or past their land, al dovar asher lo kidmu eschem belechem uvamayim. The Moabites and the Ammonites were punished for not bringing water to the Jewish people when they were traveling through the desert. Ask the Medrash, v'chitzvichim hoyu lohem liYisrael? Did the Jews need water? V'aloi kolis and aboyin shono shu Yisrael b'midbar? Didn't we learn that for all those 40 years they were in the midbar? Hoyu haman yored lohem, v'habeiro yileh, v'haslav motzu lohem, v'anonei kovet mekifiz nesom, v'yomod anon nesar lifnehem? We've just learned that this chus avrom avinu, they had everything they needed. All their needs were taken care of. their water and their food and their anone covered with their the slavos, that whatever they needed was taken care of. What did they need from the Moabites? What did they need from the Ammonites? The answer is they needed nothing from them. Elo derech eretz hu. Habo min haderech makdimim lohem b'maychel u'mishteh. When somebody's come from a journey, you don't ask them whether they're hungry or thirsty. You don't ask them if they need anything. Derech Eretz is, you take to them. Whether they need it or not is irrelevant. You take, that's the Derech Eretz. Ma paro lo yanakadosh baruch hu? What was the response of Hashem to them? Mitoch kach lo yovoy amoni u'ma'avi. As a result of this, an Ammonite and a Moabite cannot marry into the Jewish people. For what? For not offering water to somebody who wasn't thirsty. For not offering food to somebody who had more food than they had. Who had absolutely no food shortage. So what was it? Once again, you see that the expectations of Derech Eretz and Chesed are not based on the needs of the object, but on the responses of the subject to a situation which would normally be one of tragedy, to one which would normally be one of pathos. If three people came walking through the heat of the day, they would normally be thirsty, they would normally be hungry. Therefore it is correct for the subject to see that situation and respond to it, not to analyze whether they fit the norm or they don't. When a nation is walking, a nation of refugees, fleeing from Mitzrayim with nowhere to go, it's normal that they have nothing to eat, they have nothing to drink. That should arouse a feeling of pathos. Once they should have looked, the Moabites and the Ammonites should have looked at these people and thought to themselves, what about the little children? What about the old people? What about the sick people? How are they managing? What are they eating? What are they drinking? And they shouldn't have taken the time to go and find out what they're eating and what they're drinking. You go and you take. There must be a situation where there's a need. The truth is there wasn't a need. So nobody suffered by their not doing the chesed. If nobody suffered, surely there was no punishment. No, look at the punishment. They can never marry into the Jewish people. A Mitzri, an Egyptian, those people who tortured us for all those years, can marry into the Jewish people. German people can marry into the Jewish people. Spanish people can marry into the Jewish people. They killed us. They murdered us. Doesn't matter. They can still marry. Not a Moabite, not an Ammonite. Because they lacked that chesed. They didn't respond with chesed in that particular situation. And so again we see that this need to respond with chesed is not based on an analysis of the needs of the object, but on the subject responding to a situation which would normally be one of pathos, one which would normally be pathetic. There's a third case. Mihu she'osu chesed imbishi chayev lo. Sometimes you do chesed not because you're responding to pathos as much as you owe it to the other person. The other person has a need and you owe it to them. Yisro Moshe, an example of that is Yisro with Moshe. Vayom Elohim, he said to his daughters, Karen Eloi v'yoichalochem. They come, Yisro's daughters come and they tell Yisro that they met this man at the well and he helped them. That's why they're quick, because he chased away the other shepherds who were bullying them. And he says, where is the man? Why didn't you invite him home for a meal? So he owes Ahakoros HaTov, he owes Moshe at least a meal. And what was his char? Bimei Shol. When Shaul had to go and smite the Amalekites, the Keni, they were descendants of Yisro, lived in the same area. And Shaul warns the Keni before the Amalekite war, you better clear out, we're about to invade. And he saves them. Why? Because of what Yisro did for Moshe, he gave him a meal. Explains the Medrash again. If a person does one act of chesed to somebody he owes a debt to, look how Hashem repays him, saves all his descendants. Can you imagine how much reward there is for somebody who does an act of chesed to a person that they don't owe anything to? And just to see it in its complete perspective, let us project and imagine combining these two kal vachomers together. What about a person who does chesed to somebody who needs the chesed and he doesn't owe anything to? Let's take the two kal vachomers together. Mihu she'osu chesed imi she'tzorich chesed. So where was a case of somebody who did a kindness to a person who needed that kindness and he didn't owe him anything? That was Boaz to Ruth. When Ruth came along, Boaz provided her with food and set her up. That was a chesed to somebody who needed the chesed and to whom he didn't owe anything at all. And what was the result of that? Mashiach. That set in motion the lineage for the birth of David HaMelech ultimately, and for the birth of Mashiach ultimately. That's where it comes from. That's how the Torah views Chesed. That is its role, that's its function. But we see that's the ultimate Chesed. Chesed to somebody you owe nothing to, when he really needs it. But on the way, we've seen other kinds of chasodim, that Chesed is important even if you owe them a Chesed, and Chesed is important, infinitely important, even if the person doesn't need the Chesed. And so we're saying, what is Chesed? Chesed is the ability to perceive in other situations the pathetic dimension. That even in simchas, that even in happy occasions and in normal setups, there's always something about it that one can perceive, and one needs to perceive, which is worthy of our sympathy, which is worthy of our feelings of identification. That's why we break a glass under a chuppah. Just to remind us, there's no such thing as perfect simcha. Certainly not while we don't have the Beis HaMikdash. There's no such thing as perfect joy, perfect harmony, perfect health. There isn't perfect anything. The only perfection is the Ribbono Shel Olam and the Torah. Apart from that, there is no perfection. There is a chink in everybody's armor. No matter how okay they appear to be, they're not okay at all. Everybody has his problem. Everybody has his difficulty. And that needs to be perceived. And Chesed is the ability to seek out the pathetic in ordinary day-to-day situations. I'm okay, you're not okay. Let me help. That's what Chesed is. I'm okay, you're okay is a Chesedless relationship. That's a relationship where there doesn't have to be Chesed. There can be equal relationship. There can be give and take. There can be dealing with one another on a business level. But there's no Chesed if I'm okay, you're okay. The only time that there's true Chesed is when I'm able to perceive a situation. I'm okay, but maybe you're not okay. What can I do to help you? That no matter what my tzoras are, I'm sure they're nothing compared to yours. Let me see if I can help you. And that's a kind of personality. That's an attitude to life. That's a way of going about things. Which does two things. Number one, it puts one's own life in perspective. And number two, it removes the defensiveness that occurs so often in human relations. I had to phone a journalist yesterday about an article that he wrote. And as I phoned him, told him who I was, I heard the prickles in his voice, ready to start defending himself. And I paused a moment, and I said, I phoned to congratulate you on a brilliant article that you wrote. And you could hear this sigh, this relief, this opening up, this warmth that came pouring out, this friendliness and friendship and desire for more contact and more conversation. And I thought to myself, poor man, every time he picks up that phone, it's somebody blasting him about something he's written. Nobody phones him if it's been okay. My daughter said to me after the Shalashuddish, because she and Merit Ofra and a couple of girls prepared the Shalashuddish, she said, three people came to say thank you. Can you imagine if it wasn't nice, how many people would have come to tell us? So I said, yeah, but you're the same. How often do you say thank you to your mother for a meal? But if it's not nice, you tell her also. She suddenly realized, that's how it is. That's how life is. We're all hammered, we're all battered, we all hear the complaints, we all hear the criticisms, we all hear the negatives. How often do we hear the compliments? How often do we hear when things are okay, even if they're not wonderful, just okay? Somebody doesn't care. If they're a little bit off okay, somebody will see that he tells us. But if it's just okay, not even wonderful, just okay, nobody will come and say, that was okay, that was nice, it was fine, it was alright. We don't hear that, and we don't do it ourselves. Ask yourselves, how many times you do that? How many times do you go up to somebody, you know, we complain about service in this country, the way we're served in shops and by government officials and so on and so forth, and sometimes we complain when we're not served well, but how often do we go up to somebody and say, thank you for the way you served me, that was nicely done? How often do we do it? What incentive do we give people to be nice to each other? We don't recognize it at all. And we're all adopting this defensive attitude, readying ourselves for the next criticism. What are we going to say in our defense? We're ready for it. And as somebody opens their mouths, we're ready to chop their heads off. We're absolutely ready for it. And when somebody gives a compliment, we're actually quite surprised and we relax. Such a feeling of relaxation. A compliment. And what does a compliment cost? Nothing. And what does it achieve? Incredible achievement. Of self-esteem, of a feeling of worth in another person, of a relaxation in another person, of a feeling good. People pay an awful lot of money to feel good. They go to all fancy health farms and all sorts of things just to feel good. And they pay a lot. It's very valuable to a person, feeling good. It's something that we should use. And if we adopt the attitude of I'm okay, you, if we adopt the attitude of I'm not okay, you're okay, well, that's probably the attitude that most of us do adopt. I'm about to be criticized. I'm not okay. You're the guy who's okay. Let's hear what you've got to say and I'll defend myself. If we've already come a long way, then we're I'm okay, you're okay. I'm ready for you, friend. I don't feel bad about anything that I've done and I'm ready to tackle you. But the other way around, I'm okay, but maybe you're not so okay. Maybe you need compliments. Maybe you're feeling insecure. Maybe you're feeling a lack of esteem. Let me see the pathos in your situation. Let me try and identify with your struggle, with your difficulty, with your feelings. That's a different thing. I once saw Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz Zatzal standing in front of a child's shoe shop and sobbing his heart out, tears running down his face. I never knew why. Today, I feel sorry that I didn't ask him why. But one can feel, whatever it was, he stood there looking at the little shoes in the shop, the cute little shoes, and he just stood there, who knows what was going through his mind, what he was thinking, what he was feeling. Stood there crying and crying, looking at the little shoes. There can be pathos in any situation. There can be heroism and romance and all sorts of things in situations, and in those same situations there is a pathetic dimension. And only when we seek out the pathetic dimension in all situations do we feel perhaps this person needs something from me too. Perhaps I'm the one who's okay. Perhaps I'm the one who can help. Perhaps I'm the one who can say a word of encouragement. That's what there needs to be for chesed. Not I'm okay, you're okay. I'm okay, you're not okay. Let me see what I can do to help. How far does that go? This is the famous Medrash, just a little bit earlier in the Medrash that I've spoken about before in the Shir, where Hillel HaZokin was walking home when he used to finish with his Talmidim, where they used to walk with him. Omru le Talmidov, his Talmidim said to him, Rebbe Lehechon HaTohelech, where are you going? What a funny question. He was going home. What was the question? But they didn't mean just where you're going. The question is with what purpose? You're walking obviously with a purposefulness. When people walk home, they linger, they take it easy. You see people walking to shul, they walk with a certain direction. You can see on Shabbos morning, you can tell where a person's going. He's dressed and he's going and he's walking in such a hurry he doesn't even say good Shabbos to you on the way. You know, he's going to shul. When he's walking home already, it's, he ambles a little bit and he's talking. He doesn't look as if he's got anywhere definite to go. He's going, you don't know if he's taking a walk around the block or if he's actually going somewhere. It's difficult to tell when a person goes home. Obviously, when Hillel HaZokin used to walk home, he walked with that same deliberateness that he used to walk to the Beis HaMedrash. So his Talmidim say, Lahechem, where are you going in such a rush with such directness? Where are you going? My guest, I'm going to do chesed with my guest at home. I said to him, you know, Rebbe, don't try and play the fool with us. If today was the only day you walked this way, I would understand. You've got a guest at home and you're in a hurry to go and help him and do things for him. But you walk like this every day. Do you have a guest every day? And my neshoma in my body, is that not a guest? One day it's here, the next day it's gone. Who knows how long it's here to stay? Is that not a guest? And he adds a word in. Hadein nefosho aluvto. This poor neshoma. Pathos. In the neshoma? Do I have to feel sorry for my neshoma? This perfect neshoma, the spark of Hashem himself? Do I have to feel pathos for my own neshoma? And how? I have to feel pathos for my own neshoma. And that enables me to say, as Hillel HaZokin says, I can do chesed with my own neshoma. It doesn't only have to be with others. I'm okay, my neshoma is not okay. Same thing. If we look at it, I'm okay, my neshoma is okay, there's nothing to do. You can go and relax on the beach. But if we say, I'm okay, my neshoma is not okay, maybe my neshoma needs me. My poor neshoma, it's not comfortable. This is not where it belongs. It's out of its field. It's out of context. My neshoma belongs up in Shemayim. It's finding it difficult. It feels uncomfortable here. It feels out of place here. It needs some help. It needs to be made to feel comfortable. It needs to be protected. It needs to be nurtured. It needs to be fed. I've got to take care of my own neshoma. It's also a neshoma aluvto. In any situation we can find the pathos, even in our own neshomas. And some of you might remember the piece of Sefer HaYosha that I learned with you when we did this medrash. Sefer HaYosha, we don't know who the author is. It's certainly a Rishon. Some say Rabbeinu Tam, some say it's the Baal HaMoyer. It's not quite clear who he is, but he has a wonderful chiddush in the 7th perek, where he's in the 7th shah, where he says that normally a thing is either a subject or an object. Kol dover poel, lo yepol. If a thing is a poel, that means it's capable of acting, then it is not acted upon. Ki im luzuloso, it can only act on something else, but not on itself. Ki lo yitochen li yos eve mi eve haguf make umuke. The same limb cannot smite and be smitten. Your hand can't smite your hand. It can smite the other hand, but it can't smite itself. And you can eat an ox's tongue, but you can't eat your own tongue. Your mouth can't eat and be eaten. And your eye cannot see and be seen. And your hand cannot construct and be constructed. You can't build your own hand. And a candle can't light itself. It can light another candle, but it can't light itself. The one that acts is not the one that's acted upon. You need a subject and you need an object, and they relate with one another. The subject and the object cannot be the same thing. The actor and the acted upon cannot be the same thing, same object. Zulosi, with one exception. Haneshoma levado. Only the neshoma is capable of being the soul, is capable of being subject and object together. Then he goes and expands on it a little bit till he gets to the point where he says, it comes out from this, that a masculine, intelligent person, just as he can teach others, he can teach himself. He doesn't need anybody else to teach him. Self-education is a possibility. Why? Because of this principle, that the neshoma is the only thing that can act upon itself. All other objects can only act upon other objects. The neshoma can act upon itself, that means it can teach itself. And because a human being has this ability to warn himself, that's why we are responsible for ourselves. That's why we get reward for the good deeds that we do, and we're punished for the bad deeds. Because we can do it all ourselves, we don't need anybody else. We have our own consciences, and we can educate ourselves, and we can teach ourselves, and we can warn ourselves, and we can refine ourselves. We can do it all ourselves. And he says an animal can't do that, a child can't do that, and a stupid person can't do that. That's why animals aren't punished, that's why children aren't punished by Ribbono Shel Olam, although they need to be punished by their parents. And that's why mad people can't be punished, because they don't have that capacity. The capacity to act upon themselves, to teach themselves, to train themselves, to refine themselves. They can't do that. That's a unique property of the intelligent adult human being. The ability to address himself and direct himself and motivate himself. That's it. And if you look at all these motivational experts, what are they telling you? How to motivate yourself. And at the end of the day, if you have to go to a motivational expert, you're never going to get it right. The people who go and spend fortunes on motivation are the people, sometimes it helps a little while, it helps for a couple of days, but they're not the real stars. The real stars are the people who don't go to motivational courses, because they don't need to. They are their own motivators. That's the key to it all, the ability to motivate yourself. If you have that, you're an intelligent being for whom the sky is the limit. And if you don't have the ability to motivate yourself, then you're in the capacity of the child, the animal, the incompetent person, to need outside motivation, to need outside education. Yes, others can help, others can provide information, others can teach skills, others can show you how. But at the end of the day, you can act upon yourself, and you must act upon yourself, and only you can act upon yourself. There is no other being that can act upon itself. And with that we understand what Hillel HaZaken says so clearly. That this act of chesed, empathizing, sympathizing, can even be with yourself. To be able to look at your poor neshoma. But most people who sympathize with themselves look at their poor bodies. And then they become terribly impossible human beings to spend any time with. People who feel miserable about themselves, poor me. What are they thinking about poor me? Oh, poor me, and I'm lonely, and poor me, and I'm neglected, and poor me, and I've got no money, and poor me, and I... Yeah, you know what it is. And they're real miserable beings. That's not what we're talking about. The self, the ability to sympathize with the self, is to sympathize with the neshoma. My poor neshoma hasn't developed the way it should have developed. I haven't attended to it the way I should have attended. I haven't done the mitzvahs I ought to have done. I haven't learnt as much Torah as I could have done. My neshoma needs attention. It needs my time. It needs my effort. It needs to be looked after. And we can take this concept of pathos even one step further. We can seek the pathetic in any human situation. And once we've sought the pathetic, we can act in chesed. We can even seek the pathetic within ourselves, but not within ourselves physically, because then we cease to be able to act with chesed. If we think we're pathetic, then I'm not okay. The moment I'm not okay, then I can't act with chesed. And that's the Medrash that we learnt in shul last night. A little bit further back, we've been working backwards in the Medrash to this evening. The Medrash says, Noisein lechem lechol boso. Hashem undertakes the obligation to provide sustenance for all living beings. Pause there. What happens if a person comes along and gives tzedakah, gives charity? V'chotaf lo yisa mitzvah. He actually steals Hashem's mitzvah. Hashem was going to do it, and he takes it. Omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, olay l'shalim lo gemulo. I'll repay him for it. Adol d'chtivu gemulo yishalim lo. Then the Medrash says, Il mole mikra kosov efshel oimro. If it weren't for a mefurish posuk, it would be impossible to say such an extreme thing. It is normal for the debtor to be a slave to the creditor. As it says in Mishle, a debtor is a slave to a creditor. What's the Medrash saying? What's so terrible about that? That means that if Hashem has the obligation to sustain everybody, then as I explained last night, when I give charity, I'm not giving charity. All I'm doing is I'm making an advance on God's behalf. That's all. It's God's responsibility to sustain this poor man. And the thing is, he's right there in front of me. I identify with pathos. He's sitting right there in front of me. I'm not going to wait until Hashem gets around to it. So I'll do it right now. But I'm paying God's debts. It's not my responsibility. It's Hashem's responsibility. It comes out that I have paid out money on behalf of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Who's the creditor? Who's the debtor? Comes out, I have made the Ribbono Shel Olam a financial debtor of mine. He owes me money. That's what it is when one gives tzedakah. Now it's interesting, depending on the creditworthiness of people, it's actually quite a good situation to be in when they owe you money. It's very nice to be in a situation where somebody, where a powerful company or powerful individual owes money. One can do all sorts of things. The banks like it also when you owe them money, although they make you try to feel, as we've often discussed, greatly indebted to them when they deign themselves to lend you money, and you're supposed to feel eternally grateful that they've actually done so. That's just the way they market themselves, but in fact that is their business, lending you money. If they didn't lend you money, they would cease to exist. They would go bankrupt very fast if they stopped lending you money. That's their lifeblood, lending you money, and they like to be owed money, and the more money they're owed, the better it is, as long as they've got good security. And our situation, where we're acting as bankers to the Ribbono Shel Olam, can you think of anything more desirable than that? To have the Ribbono Shel Olam as a debtor? He actually owes me money. And imagine if you need to borrow money, you need to go to the bank, and you can say to the bank manager, well, what assets have you got? You say, no, I don't have many assets. My house is bonded, my car's on lease, and I don't have very much, but I can tell you this, the Ribbono Shel Olam owes me a lot of money. If the bank is a Yorei Shemayim, what should he say? In that case, no problem. We're going through a very sad episode now with the Reichman brothers, who have been enormous Baalei Tzedakah, and are going through a difficult time. But I don't think they're too worried. They owe the banks a lot of money, but the Ribbono Shel Olam owes them quite a bit too. So I don't think that one needs to worry too much about them. They'll come out all right. The Ribbono Shel Olam, they've got a lot of credit coming in from a good debtor. That's how it really is. So when we are responding to the needs of the oni, we see a poor man and we give him charity. What are we doing? We're simply advancing money on behalf of the Ribbono Shel Olam. So where do we see pathos? We're seeing pathos on a dual dimension now. On the one hand, there's this poor man, Nebuch, he needs some money. On the other hand, who's supposed to give him the money? The Ribbono Shel Olam. But the Ribbono Shel Olam isn't here right now. For whatever reason, the Ribbono Shel Olam has chosen to stand aloof for a little while. And there's a sense of pathos, so to say, Nebuch, the Ribbono Shel Olam has an obligation right here, and he isn't here to fulfill it. I must do it for him. Exactly the same way as if I'm standing outside your house, and you have a poel, somebody is working for you, and it's time for him to go home, and he's come for his wages. And he needs it, Nebuch. He's got to go, still go to the shop to buy food to go home. And you, his balabos, is waiting for you. You've been held up in a traffic jam, and you can't help him out. What do? I get in, I advance the money to the laborer, and I tell you afterwards, I paid your laborer for you. Who am I doing it? Where's the pathos? It's both ways. On the one hand, Nebuch is a laborer who needs to be paid. On the other hand, Nebuch is a balabos who can't get you. He's got a duty to pay his laborer, and he's not here to pay him. What will he do? So I'm acting out of a sense of sympathy with both parties. And so we see, not only is it possible to feel I'm okay, you're not okay about ourselves vis-a-vis other people, but it's even possible to feel I'm okay, you're not okay about myself. My body's okay, my neshama needs a bit of attention. That also one's able to feel. Not only am I able to feel it about myself, but I'm even able to feel it, kibiyochel, so to say, about the Ribbono Shel Olam. Maybe you too, Ribbono Shel Olam, need some help from me, so to say. Of course, the Ribbono Shel Olam needs nothing from us. But he sometimes acts, just as Lahavdil, we gave an example at the beginning of the shir, of a situation which is acted out, which arouses our pathos and needs us to respond with that pathos. Just as Avraham Avinu had to show sympathy to the angels, although they didn't need it. So there are times where kibiyochel we've got to show sympathy to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Ribbono Shel Olam, you have a duty to do here and you're not here at the moment. So I'll do it for you. I'll help you out. The ability of a human being to help the Ribbono Shel Olam out, that's something which is so uniquely Jewish. There is no other religion, there is no other philosophy, there is no way of life that gives man such power, the ability to even show a chesed, so to say, to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Even the ability, so to say, to make the Ribbono Shel Olam indebted to us. The ability to advance money on behalf of the Ribbono Shel Olam and make a debtor out of the Ribbono Shel Olam. And why do we do that? Why do we lend people money? Because we feel sorry for them. Because they need it. Because we identify with them. Because we see a dimension of pathos in their situation and we respond with a loan. So even in the case of the Ribbono Shel Olam, there are the odd times where we respond with a loan, where we advance money which he ought to pay, and we'll get it back some other time. And that gives us a wider concept of the element of chesed. Chesed is not just seeing that somebody needs something and providing his need. That's not chesed. Chesed is something that applies in every situation, 24 hours a day, all the time. Whether we are relating to the world in general, whether we are relating to our own families, to our employees or to our colleagues, whether we are relating to ourselves, and even whether when we are relating to the Ribbono Shel Olam himself, in all situations, no situation is perfect in this world. And in every situation there's a little inadequacy, there's a little need, there's a little pathos. We need to hone in on that too. Not only to see the pathos, not only to see the hardship, not only to see the negative, but to be able to see that too. To be able to identify the suffering in every situation. To be able to respond to that suffering and to act upon that suffering to alleviate it, thereby expressing what the Torah calls chesed and what the Ribbono Shel Olam repays so many times over and over again. That's a view of chesed. That's an understanding of the richness of human experience. The ability not just to go through life responding to needs, not just to go through life to responding to joys, but going through life on a constant ability 24 hours a day to be able to alleviate the suffering of those about us.